I would be happy to repeat or perhaps to have a translation for a key word or phrase or something as we proceed. So if there's something you would like clarified, please interrupt. And we can try to clarify. But thanks very much to Mikhail for arranging this discussion. And thanks very much to all of you for your interest and for your presence tonight. I thought before I my topic obviously is the alleged transformation problem, but I thought before I began this somewhat complicated subject of the logic of and the logical structure of Marxist theory, I thought I would first just say a few words about the empirical explanatory power of Marxist theory. Several years ago, I received an award, a Distinguished Scholar Award from my college. And I gave a talk at the award ceremony, which I entitled, Why I Am a Marxist Economist. And the main reason that I discussed was the tremendous explanatory power of Marxist theory in terms of explaining the main phenomena of capitalist economies, which I think is far superior to the explanatory power of mainstream economics, which I think is very meager. So I thought today I would just take a few minutes to remind ourselves of this explanatory power and just briefly mention the main empirical phenomena explained by Marxist theory, so while we're kind of immersed in the details of the logic, we don't forget the overwhelming explanatory power. And this is just a slide borrowed from that talk, a summary of the most important phenomena explained by Marxist theory. And of course, profit or surplus value is the most important, the primary phenomena from which all of the other phenomena are derived. And of course, according to Marxist theory, profits produced by surplus labor. And from this theory of profit, all the other phenomena listed there can be explained. And as surprising as it may seem, mainstream economics has no good theory of profit. In fact, mainstream macroeconomics has no theory of profit at all. I mean, I was quite astonished when I first learned this in graduate school, that profit, or the rate of profit, right, is not included in the theory, right? It's not a variable. Right? It's a mathematical theory. It's not a variable in the theory. So it just seems incredible to me that one would try to explain capitalism without including profit. But that is mainstream macroeconomics. And if anything, it's getting further and further away from addressing the question of profit. Mainstream microeconomics does have a theory of profit, but it's very weak. It's called the marginal productivity theory, and that theory has been largely discredited in recent decades, except for the neoclassical true believers. So this is in itself a striking contrast between what Marxist theory can explain and mainstream economics is unable to explain, this all-important phenomena of profit. And then there are these other important phenomena, the inherent conflicts between capitalists and workers over wages and the length of the working day and the intensity of labor, endogenous technological change, the trend in the rate of profit, endogenous boom-bust cycles. Again, mainstream economics can explain none of these important phenomena of capitalist economies. The mainstream economics, instead of trying to explain the conflicts between capitalists and workers, generally emphasizes the harmony of interest between capitalists, you know, rather than conflicts, harmony and mutual satisfaction. And technological change in mainstream economics, technology is either assumed to be constant, right? If it's examined at all, it's assumed to be what economists call exogenous. Do you know the word exogenous? It means external, right? Right, outside of the theory, right? I mean, I myself had never heard the word exogenous until I took economics, right? And then you hear it all the time, right? Assume an exogenous shock, right? And then how does the economy adjust? So this is clearly not a very satisfactory theory. Of course, there's no theory of profit, so there's no theory of the trend in the rate of profit. The boom-bust cycle, again, is assumed to be the result of some accidents, exogenous, not due to the internal nature of capitalist economy. So, in general, I argue that Marx's theory has much greater explanatory power than mainstream economics. I would say it's not even close. I mean, the difference is tremendous. For most of these phenomena, I mean, these are the most important phenomena that Marx's theory is concerned with, right? This is what he focuses on, whereas mainstream economics doesn't even address these important phenomena. So I just want to remind ourselves, while we're considering the details of the logic of Marx's theory, we shouldn't forget this tremendous explanatory power. And I would be happy to discuss any of these specific points later, if you wish. So now to the transformation problem. We'll get to the tables in a minute. The well-known tables from Chapter 9, Volume 3. Of course, the main reason for rejecting Marx's theory over the last century or so has been this alleged logical problem. So kind of aside from the empirical explanatory power, the main criticism has been a logical problem. Criticism, the alleged transformation problem, which has to do, I'm sure you're all familiar, with the alleged contradiction between the labor theory of value, on the one hand, and the tendency for the rate of profit to be equal across industries. Right? This appears to be a contradiction, and that the labor theory of value cannot explain this equalization of the rate of profit across industries. The labor theory of value seems to imply that industries with unequal compositions of capital, right, unequal ratios of constant capital to variable capital, should have unequal rates of profit. Right? If you just do a straightforward deduction, and the critics of Marx's theory argue that Marx attempted to resolve this contradiction between the labor theory of value and equal rates of profit with his theory of prices of production in Part 2 of Volume 3, but the critics argue he failed. Right? Marx's solution to the problem failed, and the reason why he failed, it is argued, is that he I'm sure you've heard this phrase, maybe not in English, is that he failed to transform the inputs of constant capital and variable capital from values to prices of production. Maybe you ought to translate that just to... Yeah, do we need to, or no?
Dass die Inputs in Werten gerechnet werden, dann wird der Mehrwert umgeteilt und es kommen die Produktionspreise raus. Und da ist der übliche Einwand, ja, aber die Inputs, also der Kostpreis, der müsste doch auch transformiert werden. Das macht Marx nicht in diesen Tabellen. Also wird gesagt, er scheitert mit der Transformation.
Right. So this was the crucial mistake, right? That Marx failed to solve. And critics point to the tables, right, to the well-known tables. The cost price is the sum of constant capital and variable capital. And you can see that the cost price is the same for both the value table and the price of production table. And this is supposed to be Marx's mistake. Right, that he should transform the inputs, but he left them the same. And then the critics argue that Marx's failure can be overcome by a method first suggested by Bortkowitz in the early 20th century, which utilizes a different logical method, a system of simultaneous equations that solves the prices both of the inputs and the outputs simultaneously along with the rate of profit. Excuse me. However, the Bortkowitz solution, so to speak, results in a number of damaging conclusions or implications, right? That Marx's two aggregate equalities, total price equal to total value and total profit equal to total surplus value, cannot both be satisfied at the same time, right? So Marx's claim that they could be solved simultaneously is false, the critics argue. And then the price rate of profit determined by the Bortkowitz method is not the same as the value rate of profit determined by Marx's theory. And so the value rate of profit is really of no use in determining the price rate of profit. And the price rate of profit may have a different trend over time than the value rate of profit. So for all these reasons, Marx's theory is logically inconsistent and should be rejected. Right? This is the familiar logical criticism. Now, of course, there's been a long controversy over the transformation problem with many participants, including some innovative interpretations in recent decades. I'm not going to try to review this long debate. I'm going to focus on and present my own interpretation. I would be happy to discuss other interpretations during the discussion. One especially perhaps of interest is the so-called new interpretation presented in recent decades by Duncan Foley and Gerard Dumanil. It would be one such other interpretation which I would be happy to discuss. In fact, I argue that to some extent my interpretation is kind of an extension of the new interpretation. So what I argue, contrary to the critics, is that Marx did not fail to transform the inputs from values to prices of production because the inputs are not supposed to be transformed. Right? Marx's tables are correct, I'm going to eventually argue. C and V, constant capital and variable capital, are supposed to be the same. in the determination of both values and prices of production, and we'll see just what the nature of those magnitudes are. And thus, I argue Marx's theory of prices of production is logically complete and coherent, and that this long-standing criticism of Marx's theory is not valid, and the rejection of Marx's theory on these grounds, the widespread rejection of Marx's theory on this basis, is not a valid rejection. So I want to emphasize the logical method employed by Marx in the construction of his theory in Capital, and reconsider the transformation problem from this broader perspective of Marx's logical method. I think the long debate over the transformation problem has not paid sufficient attention to the nature of Marx's logical method, and as a result, I think erroneous conclusions are reached concerning whether or not Marx's transformation is consistent. After all, this is a logical criticism, right? So, in order to really evaluate this criticism, we need to carefully and understand as clearly as we can what is Marx's logic, right? And if Marx's logic is misunderstood in the criticisms, then the criticisms are not valid. This is a well-known quote from the Postface, the second edition, where Marx reviews some of the reviews of the first edition, and he says that the method employed in Capital has been little understood, is shown by the various mutually contradictory conceptions that have been formed of it. And he goes through several such mutually contradictory conceptions. And unfortunately, I think Marx's logical method is still not adequately understood. And so that's what I'm trying to focus on. There are two main aspects of Marx's logical method that I want to emphasize and that I emphasize in my work that are especially relevant to the transformation problem. And I characterize these two aspects simply as macroeconomics and monetary. I refer to my interpretation as the macro-monetary interpretation of Marx's theory. Marx's theory is primarily, I argue, a macro theory in the sense that the main variable refers to the total economy, the total surplus value produced in the economy as a whole. That Marx's theory is also primarily a monetary theory. Is trying to that the total surplus value that Marx is trying to explain is a monetary variable. It's delta M, right, or delta G, I guess, in German. So let me. I want to discuss these two macro and monetary aspects of Marx's method in some detail. So first, the macro aspect. I argue that there are two main levels of abstraction in Marx's theory that can be described in various ways. Primarily, I would argue the two levels of abstraction are, on the one hand, the production of surplus value, right? The determination of the total surplus value produced in the economy as a whole. And that's in volumes 1 and 2. The second level of abstraction is the distribution of surplus value, or the division of the total surplus value into individual parts, presented in volume 3. The first, the equalization of profit rates across industry, and then the further division of the total surplus value into commercial profit, interest, and rent. And the key point about this logical method is that the production of surplus value, there's a logical sequence here, from production to distribution, right? And that the production of surplus value is theorized prior, before the distribution of surplus value. And the total surplus value produced in the economy as a whole is determined logically prior to the division, the whole before the parts. The total surplus value is determined at the first level of abstraction, the production of surplus value. And then the key point is this predetermined total surplus value is then presupposed at the second level of abstraction, is then taken as given in the distribution, the division of the total into individual parts. I argue that this logical progression, right, from the total surplus value to the individual parts follows directly from Marx's labor theory of value and labor theory of surplus value. According to Marx's theory, all the individual parts of surplus value come from the same source, right, the surplus labor of workers. Therefore, the total surplus value must be determined first, right, by surplus labor, and then this total surplus value is divided into the individual parts, which also depend on other factors, additional secondary factors besides surplus labor. Marx also referred to these two levels of abstraction in Hegelian terms as capital in general and competition or many capitals. And in the language of modern economics, I'm an economist, we could refer to these two levels of abstraction as the macro level of abstraction, the total economy, and the micro level, the individual industries. To take the most important and relevant example here for the transformation problem, in Marx's theory of prices of production in part 2 of volume 3, the total surplus value produced in the economy as a whole in a year, right, is taken as a predetermined given, as determined in volumes 1 and 2. And then this predetermined total surplus value is used to determine the general rate of profit, which in turn is used to determine prices of production. And this kind of logical sequence is summarized in this next slide. First, the total surplus value is determined. Then the rate of profit is determined as the aggregate ratio of the total surplus value and to the total capital advance. And then this rate of profit is used to as one of the determinants of prices of production. And as a result of this logical sequence, the predetermined total surplus value is distributed to the individual industries in such a way that all industries receive the same general rate of profit. So, in fact, prices of production and equal rates of profit are explained by this method on the basis of the labor theory of value. Right? There's no contradiction between the labor theory of value and equal rates of profit. Now, the transformation problem has often been interpreted as a transformation, what I would call from micro to micro, right? From individual prices, from individual values, right? In volume one, it's interpreted to individual prices of production. It's the way the transformation is often interpreted, but I don't think that's Marx's logic. It's not micro to micro. It's macro to micro. It's first the determination of the total, and then the division in individual parts, and the determination of individual prices of production. The standard interpretation misses entirely the all-important macro aspect of Marx's theory, Marx's logical method, and the logical priority of the total surplus value. The transformation problem, I argue, is essentially a disaggregation problem. Right? You start with the aggregate, the total surplus value, and then you divide up, you disaggregate into individual parts. But this macro prior macro level of abstraction is often overlooked in the standard interpretation. I think the textual evidence in Capital to support this macro aspect of Marx's logical method is very strong, and I would say conclusive. I don't think there can be any doubt that this is at least what Marx was trying to do, right? Whether or not this was ultimately successful remains to be seen, but I think this is clearly, in my view, Marx's intention. By the way, I learned this macro aspect of Marx's theory from a Berliner named Paul Matic. If you're familiar with Paul Matic Sr., who in my opinion is the greatest Marxist economist of the 20th century, and he of course grew up right here in Berlin, participated in the Spartacist uprising after World War I before immigrating to the U.S. And then I had the good fortune to participate in a Capital study group led by Matic in the early 1970s in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Not in any university, this was the best way to read Capital, by political activists outside the university. And this was one of the main points that Matic stressed to us, that Marx's theory is primarily a macro theory. And this was the main point of Matic's critique of Baran and Sweezy, familiar with Baran and Sweezy's monopoly capital, right? And they argue, you know, Baran and Sweezy argued that monopolies overcome Marx's theory of the falling rate of profit, right? They argued that the falling rate of profit is replaced by the law of the rising surplus, right? Because monopolies are able to get a higher rate of profit. But Matic argued that monopolies have no effect on the total surplus value, on the general rate of profit. Monopolies succeed often in getting a higher than average rate of profit, but this does not change or increase the average rate of profit itself. Monopolies get a higher than average rate of profit, but that means that the competitive industries must necessarily get a lower than average rate of profit. And so the general rate of profit is determined at the macro level by surplus labor, right? And not by the degree of monopoly, as Kolesky would say. Okay, I apologize for my voice. I hope it holds up. My voice is not what it used to be. My doctor calls it an aging voice. So it is what it is. So the second main aspect of Marx's logical method that I emphasize has to do with the circuit of money capital, right? Which I argue is the basic logical framework of Marx's theory overall, expressed in this familiar. This is in English. You know it all in German. I think this circuit of money capital captures the essence of what capitalism is primarily about, and focuses Marx's theory on this most important phenomenon of capitalism. Where does the delta M come from, right? And what determines its magnitude? This is what capitalism is all about. And this is what Marx's theory is primarily about. So this is not just, you know, a minor illustration in Chapter 4 of Volume 1. This is the overall logical framework for the whole theory. Right? And surplus value is defined by Marx as delta M. This is references to the English definition of surplus value as the delta M that emerges at the end of the circuit of capital. And I like this quote at the bottom too, which I think kind of summarizes the theory. Before production, right, we had a capital of 500 pounds. After production, we have the capital of 500 pounds plus an increment of another 100 pounds. Right? And this is what Marx's theory is trying to explain, where the 100 pounds comes from. Right? Starting with 500, how does it get to be 600? Marx, I think, first developed this MC, M prime framework in the second draft of Capital, in the beginning of the manuscript of 1861 to 63, which was published for the first time in the Mega in the late 1970s, volume 3.1. And this is a very interesting and important manuscript. If you're not familiar with it, I strongly encourage to take a look. I think this previously unpublished second draft of volume one is really one of the main contributions of the Mega, and this is where Marx is first kind of developing this circuit of capital as his logical framework. And I don't think this has received the attention it deserves from interpretations of Marx. I was happy to see that Mikhail emphasizes the circuit of money capital in his recent book on capital, although I would still say not enough emphasis in my view, right? But a common misinterpretation of Volume 1 is that Volume 1 is only about labor times. No, only about labor values, and value and surplus value is only measured only in labor times in volume one, and prices only are introduced in volume three. At least in among English Marxists, this is a fairly common interpretation, and I think this is a fundamental misinterpretation, which loses sight of the essential monetary nature of capitalism and of Marx's theory of capitalism. Marx's money is derived in chapter one of volume one. It's the necessary form of appearance of the value of commodities. And from that point on, Marx's theory is about quantities of money, delta M, right, that are explained, that represent and thus explained by quantities of labor time. So it's not just labor time, it's labor time that determines quantities of money, and above all else, that determines delta M. Skip over. Well, this circuit of money capital, to some extent, Marx took over from the classical economists, or at least they had a similar framework, which they often described as money advance, money advances, right, and money returns. It was their language. This is the way Marx described the mercantilist. Of course, what the mercantilist missed was production and the source of the delta M. But this was a fairly common framework. Colonel Torrens. Also was pretty consistent with this kind of framework, Malthus at times. And I discovered recently that Schumpeter called this particular brand or this particular aspects of capital, of classical economics, is what he called advance economics. I had not run across that term before, because of this characteristic of the advance of money capital as the starting point of the analysis of the theory. And Schumpeter also said that Marx also, he says, quotes, belongs to the family that we have called advance economics. Unfortunately, Schumpeter didn't say much more about the importance of this logical structure. So I think Marx's framework of the circuit of money capital was within this classical tradition. Focusing on the money circuit, that this is the way capitalism should be analyzed, as money advanced, that becomes more money. On the other hand, by contrast, Sraffa's theory has a very different logical framework, right? That his framework is more in physical terms, in terms of physical quantities of inputs and outputs. Q stands for quantity there, and quantity of physical inputs and outputs. So I've tried to kind of to contrast Sraffa's method with Marx's method. I've expressed it in terms of these symbols. And the most striking difference between Sraffa's framework and Marx's framework is the complete absence of money, in my view, and especially the absence of delta M, the most important characteristic. I don't see how this can possibly be an adequate theory of capitalism. And of course, Sraffa's theory is these days often used. There is a very widespread and popular Sraffian interpretation of Marx's theory, right, in these same terms. And so I would argue is a misinterpretation for the same reason. Could I have a little more water? Of course. Okay, so now we come to the crucial point, okay, and probably the most controversial point, right? And I argue further that Marx's logical structure of the circuit of money capital suggests that the initial M at the beginning of the circuit is taken as given, is presupposed in Marx's theory, both in the volume one theory of the total surplus value and in the volume three micro theory of the distribution of surplus value. And I think that's true for two reasons. In the first place, obviously, the start of the circuit of capital is M, right? Which suggests that money, this is Marx's framework, right? So it would suggest that the initial M is the starting point of Marx's theory of this process, right? Of M becoming M plus delta M. M is the initial data, right? Which is used to explain the outcome. The circuit of money capital begins with the advance of a definite quantity of money M to purchase means of production and labor power. And Marx's theory of this process begins with the quantity of money capital advance. The initial M exists. It's like the before production we have a capital of 500 pounds, right, that we read before, right? And so this M exists as a definite magnitude, right, at the beginning of the circuit, the 500 pounds, and is in principle a known quantity, right? And so it's legitimate to take this known quantity as a given at the beginning of the theory in order to explain the outcome of the process, the M plus delta M. So Marx's theory, I argue, proceeds from the known quantity M, the 500 pounds, to the unknown and eventually explained M plus delta M, the 600. So that's the first reason. The second reason that I think this circuit implies that Marx took the original M as given is that the first phase of the circuit of capital, the MC, right, takes place in the sphere of circulation, right, prior to the second phase of production. And so Marx's theory also begins in the sphere of circulation, right, in parts one and two of volume one, with the advance of definite quantities of money capital to purchase the input. So when the second phase of production, the P, begins, as analyzed in part three of volume one and beyond, the quantity M, the C, and the constant capital and variable capital are assumed to have already been advanced in the sphere of circulation, the 500 pounds, and these already existing quantities of constant capital and variable capital are taken as given as the initial data in Marx's theory of how the previously existing M becomes, through the production and sale of commodities, a greater quantity. So in this way, the presuppositions of Marx's theory of production, right, and the production of surplus value in the sphere of production comes from the sphere of circulation and from the prior analysis of the sphere of circulation and the advance of money capital in the sphere of circulation. Now, there are many passages in the various drafts of Capital in which Marx stated explicitly that the M at the beginning of the circuit of capital is taken as given, or often he says is presupposed. And one of the clearest such statements, one of the clearest such statements is on the handout that I passed around. And if there are extra copies, maybe some who came in late don't have a copy. So this comes from the results manuscript, which was intended as a transition from volume one, a kind of summary of volume one, and a transition to volume two. And in this passage, I mean, we won't take time to read the whole thing, obviously, but Marx states clearly and repeatedly that a definite quantity of money, capital, is the point of departure, he says, for his theory of the production of surplus value. And he says the initial quantity of money capital is taken as a given magnitude, right? In the beginning of the process, he says, capital exists as a given quantity of money in which, notice especially I emphasize, in which all use values are extinguished, right? So that nothing remains but money, right? But the money form. Sraffians, please take note, right? All use values, all physical quantities are extinguished, right? What this is about is money becoming more money. Our task, Marx says toward the end, is to explain how the given initial presupposed quantity of money capital becomes M plus delta M at the end of the process. Right, and there are other similar passages throughout the manuscripts. We'll publish a book soon on this whole subject, and one of my chapters is on the textual evidence on this particular issue, where I go through all the manuscripts, and you know, there's also contradictory evidence, and I'll discuss that a little bit later, and I discuss at some length in my chapter, but I think it's a pretty thorough examination of the textual evidence, and I argue ultimately certainly can be interpreted to support this interpretation. That chapter is about 25,000 words, so it's a pretty thorough treatment. Now, another reason why I think the initial M is taken as given, this is the key controversial point, right? In Marx's theory of delta M, is that I argue Marx's theory of money capital refers in principle to the actual capitalist economy. This is not a hypothetical economy in which commodities are assumed to exchange at their values, right? This is the actual capitalist economy, and the M refers to actual quantities of money capital advanced to purchase means of production and labor power, not to hypothetical quantities that are, as in the traditional interpretation.
Already in volume one?
Yes, already in volume one. That's an important point. The delta M, right, in volume one, I argue, is about the actual. Right, we're not starting with a hypothetical economy. We're starting with the actual economy, and not with the hypothetical that later has to be transformed. Right. Volume one is about the actual capitalist economy and the actual total delta M. Actual.
Die tatsächliche Ökonomie, das, also dass die Formel GWG' vom vierten Kapitel hat es nicht mit einer fiktiven Ökonomie zu tun, wo zu Werten getauscht wird, sondern dieses erste G bezieht sich bereits auf ganz normale Preise, wie wir sie in der Actual Economy, der tatsächlichen Ökonomie, vorfinden, und dann wird etwas mit Werten erklärt. Und nicht erst im dritten Band kommen wir zur tatsächlichen Ökonomie. Das ist der Punkt, wo ich auch denke, das ist ein großer Unterschied, a big difference to other interpretations.
Right. Thank you. Okay, so volume 3 is then a continuation of this theory of the actual capitalist economy, and takes as a predetermined magnitude the total surplus value already, the actual total surplus value already determined, and then analyzes the division, the distribution. Now, so volume one is about the actual total delta M, right? But in order for that to be true, then the initial M at the beginning of the circuit must also refer to the actual quantities of money capital advanced in the first phase of the circuit of capital to purchase means of production and labor power. The initial M cannot be hypothetical quantities, because then the delta M would be a hypothetical quantity, which could not be presupposed in the volume three theory of the distribution of surplus value. Right. So, however, right. So I'm saying the delta M is the actual from the beginning, and the M is the actual. But actual means it's equal to prices of production, right? It's not equal to the values of the means of production and labor power, means of subsistence, and prices of. But prices of production cannot be explained in volume one. Right? Prices of production have to do with the distribution of surplus value, and the distribution of surplus value cannot be explained until volume three. Right? So M is the actual M, but the full determination of M cannot be given in volume one, because the M is equal to prices of production, and prices of production cannot be explained in volume one. Before prices of production, the distribution of surplus value can be explained. First, the total amount of surplus value must be explained, and that's the task of volume one. So in order to explain the actual total delta M, the actual M is taken as given, presupposed, as the initial data in the theory. Okay, so these are the two aspects of Marx's logical method that I emphasize, right? The prior determination of the total surplus value and the circuit of money capital as the logical framework of Marx's theory, which I argue implies that the initial M at the beginning of the circuit is the initial data for Marx's theory of delta M. So now, to try to explain briefly and kind of more in detail and quantitatively how this is supposed to work in Marx's theory of surplus value and prices of production, I'd like to turn our attention to some algebra, right, on the reverse side. And we're not going to try to go through all the details here. I just want to try to emphasize a few points, and we can certainly discuss more of the details, and I assume and hope we will, later during the discussion period. So I argue that the quantities of constant capital and variable capital, I also have this, I guess, on the slide, but I think it's easier to see from the sheet. I argue that the quantities of constant, the C and the V, right, are taken as given, right, at both levels of abstraction. And this is indicated in my notation here by a bar, a line, right? It's kind of typical algebraic notation, right? And I want to emphasize, right, that the C and V are taken as given. And so we have the bar over those variables in the algebra. And then the key assumption of the labor theory of value is that the new value component of the price of commodities, the N, the capital N, in my algebra here, depends on the quantity of current labor in the economy, the total quantity of current labor in all industries in the economy as a whole. So the key labor theory of value assumption on the handout is over on the right-hand side. The N is equal to M times L, right? Where M is the money value produced per hour. In the English literature, that's referred to these days as the melt. I don't know, the M-E-L-T, the melt, the monetary expression of labor time. It's the money value produced per hour of abstract labor. Right. In Marx's chapter 7, you know, Basic Theory of Surplus Value, in chapter 7 of volume 1, the melt is a half shilling per hour. Remember the familiar illustration? So in 6 hours, at the rate of a half shilling per hour, 3 shillings worth of new value is produced. And then in the 12-hour working day, at the rate of a half shilling per hour, 6 shillings.
You refer to chapter 7. In German edition, it is chapter 5. We have different numbering of chapters in Capital Volume 1.
Okay, so chapter 5.
But
it's the theory of surplus value, right? It's the basic theory. Starting at the top, surplus value, right, is just by definition the difference between price and cost. Constant capital, the C, right, is taken as given both as a component of the cost and as a component of the price, and thus cancels out, right, in the determination of surplus value, plays no role. That's why it's called constant capital, right? V, variable capital, is taken as given as a component of the cost, right? And this given V is subtracted from the new value produced in order to determine the surplus value produced. Surplus value is the excess of the new value produced over the given variable capital advanced. And this difference between the new value produced and the variable capital advance depends on the difference between the total labor time of workers and the necessary labor time, or we could say, of course, depends on the surplus, is proportional to the surplus labor time of workers. Right? So I think that's a kind of straightforward logical deduction of the determination of surplus value. This same theory applies to each and every worker, right, and thus implicitly applies to all workers together, and thus determines the total surplus value produced in the economy as a whole. And the point I want to emphasize again is that the C and the V that are taken as given are the actual quantities, as empirical quantities, as known quantities, advanced at the beginning of the circuit of capital. They're in volume one. They're not hypothetical quantities that could be used to determine a hypothetical surplus value, which then would later have to be transformed. into the actual magnitudes, right? Then from Marx's theory of the total surplus value, then the generator profit is determined as the ratio of these aggregate magnitudes, the total surplus value, which now has been determined in relationship to the total capital advanced. And then this generator profit is used, as we've seen before and as you know, to determine prices of production. Prices of production are the cost, the given cost in each industry, plus the average profit, determined by the product of the generator profit and the capital advanced in this industry. And this is really, I argue, all there is to it. Right? That this really, ultimately, I think, I mean, Marx says in Theories of Surplus Value, it's extraordinarily simple. Right, I think that's a little exaggeration, but it's not that complicated, right? We don't need matrix algebra, right? We don't need to invert matrices. We don't need to search for eigenvalues, as in the Sroffian interpretation. It's just a straightforward logical derivation from the macro to the micro. With the initial quantities of money capital taken as given. And the crucial point, right, I'm almost done here, the crucial point for the transformation problem is that I argue that the C sub I's and the individual quantities of C and V that are taken as given in Marx's theory of prices of production are the very same quantities of constant capital and variable capital that are taken as given in volume one in the macro theory, in the theory of the total surplus value. The only difference is the level of aggregation, right? In volume one, the total C and V are taken as given. In volume three, the individual amounts in each industry is taken as given. So the question that Marx's theory of prices of production is intended to answer, I think, is this. How is the actual C and V advanced in each industry recovered, right? That's the first component, right? Plus the average profit over and above that capital advance appropriated in each industry. That's the second component. And so for this question, the appropriate initial given is the capital invested advance, the actual capital advance in each industry. Right? That determines how much cost must be recovered before the average profit can be appropriated. So in my view, as I said earlier, the tables, Marx's tables in chapter one, are what Marx intended, right? That the cost price should be the same in the determination both of the aggregate amounts and the individual amounts. And one of the clearest statements of this important point, that the cost price is the same, supposed to be the same, assumed to be the same, in the determination of values and prices of production, is in the second quote on this side of the handout, which I've called the missing paragraph. And the reason why I call it the missing paragraph is because it's in Marx's original volume 3 manuscript, and the manuscript was 63 to 65, but Engels didn't include it in his edited version of volume 3 for some reason, which I can't understand, and I think is a bad mistake. And, you know, again, this is just an excerpt. It goes on for somewhat longer. But I think we can see from this remarkable passage that Marx states clearly and repeatedly right? Including in unambiguous algebraic formulations, right? That the cost price is the same. The K is the same in the determination of both value and prices of production.
And this is a sentence by Marx.
That is, this is a paragraph by Marx, right? In the middle of, you know, what Engels was his chapter 9, Marx is chapter 2. So it's in Marx, but not in Engels. And he actually says a similar sort of thing in other places in chapter 9, right? But it's not as clear, I think, and not kind of straightforward and unmistakable. I think as this, which I think is a very important contribution of the Mega, once again, to bring this key paragraph to light. And we can see throughout this paragraph, there's only one cost price, right, which is represented algebraically by K, right, over and over again. There are not two cost prices, one for the value component and one for the price of production. It's value is equal to K plus, price of production is equal to the same K plus. P means the average profit, right? And actually, that's a mistake in the slide. In Marx's sentence here, he used the abbreviation P prime, but it refers to the average profit. Right, it's the average profit determined the way we just determined it, right? As the generator profit times the capital advanced. Yeah.
And that's price of production.
and the PPD is price of production. Yes.
German for clothes price.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So you know, in this sentence and in similar sentences, but I think especially clear here, K is the same throughout. And particularly the last part of the paragraph that I've separated off, the last four or five lines, all these detailed comparisons in the last part, that value is equal to, greater than, or less than price of production. Notice, if and only if, right, the surplus value is equal to, greater than, or less than the average profit, that this sentence makes sense, right, is correct, right, if and only if the K's are the same for value and prices of production. If the K's are different, then it's not necessarily true that if surplus value is greater than the average profit, that value will be greater than price of production, right, because the K's could offset that, right? So either Marx is talking nonsense here, right? Or he means what he says, right? That the K's are the same, and that value is greater than price of production if and only if surplus value is greater than the average profit. So I think this missing paragraph is clear and strong evidence for this kind of monetary interpretation of the initial givens in Marxist theory, and I think it's really too bad Engels left it out. So this is why I conclude, right, that Marx did not fail to transform the inputs, right? That constant capital and variable capital are supposed to be the same, right? There is no transformation that's necessary or appropriate in Marxist theory. The inputs C and B, K, are the same in volume one as in volume three, and they are the actual quantities in both volume one and volume three. The only difference is the level of aggregation. So it follows from this definition, not only did Marx not fail, but all of the other supposed problems of the Bortkowitz solution disappear, right? Then this you have on your algebra sheet too, that Marx's two aggregate equalities are satisfied, always satisfied, and satisfied as a matter of logical method. Right? These equalities are not conditional equalities that are true only if the composition of capital is the same in all industries, as in the usual definition. These equalities are true by assumption. They can only be always true because of the nature of Marx's logic.
You said before that your argumentation is basically algebra, and then you said it's not necessary to have a matrix algebra or something like that. So this would be the case if I try to understand the interpretation of Borkiewicz or something like that. Then I need a matrix algebra or something like that. Is it right? Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Yes. I'm not saying you don't need algebra.
Sorry.
Period. I mean, I think a little algebra helps.
Yeah, yeah, yes.
Right. But it's matrix algebra.
Algebra.
Right. The input-output
yes.
matrix, the linear production theory.
Kind of
in general. So that's my argument, right? That why there's no transformation problem in Marx's theory. Marx did not fail. There's no problem to be solved. I'll go just a few more minutes if I can if you'll be patient, please. So mainstream economists, I would argue, no longer have the excuse of the transformation problem as a reason to reject Marx's theory. They now, I would argue, have to consider, right, the extraordinary empirical explanatory power of Marx's theory. There's no logical problem, so then the validity, the acceptability of Marx's theory hinges on the empirical status, the empirical explanatory power, which I argue is far superior in Marx's theory. So I'm sure they'll try to figure out some other reason for rejecting Marx's theory, but I think it will be, more obvious, right? That their reason for rejecting Marx's theory is not scientific, right? It's not valid, but ideological, right? Should I stop here? I wanted to say a little bit about the contrary textual evidence.
I think the argument was very impressive, and maybe there are already now several questions.
Okay, and we can come back to other
course.
Issues.
So first, many, many thanks for this presentation.
Thank you.
Which was, I think, very clear. It's a very difficult matter, but nevertheless, you presented it, I think, very clearly, very understandable. And I think your main argument is really new, and this means something in this debate about the transformation problem, where we have heard nearly every version, every idea of what can be formulated. So your basic contribution is to say there is not this transformation from value to production prices where we run in all these quantitative differences, because already in volume one, when Marx starts with his famous formula, the advances, what the first M or G in Deutsch expresses, relates to production prices. It is not a value which later has to be transformed, and then we are confronted with all these problems.
Not yet explained.
Not yet explained.
But
maybe this is the problem for the reader. The Marx in the text talks about values in the first three chapters. He tries to explain what means value, the relation value and money, then we see this famous formula, money, commodity, more money. And here we have to make a difference, according to what you presented, a difference which is not clearly stated by Marx. So at least I think for volume one, we still have when we follow you, we still have to criticize Marx a little bit, because not to state so clearly what he has done. But this would be a very different critic from all the traditional critics. Okay. Now, yes, I see. Start. Who else wants?
Stefan Krüger. I'm very glad about your interpretation of the so-called transformation problem, because I think your point of view is the original Marx one. And the main reason is that I think that we are discussing reality in capital and no abstract theories. And he pointed out in the preface, in the English meaning is, of course, the method of presentation must differ in form from that of inquiry. The latter has to appropriate material detail to analyze its different forms of development to trace out the inner connection. Only after this work is done can the actual movement, what you said, can the actual movement be adequately described. And I think the presentation of the continent capital is nothing else but the description of reality following the movement of capital. That's one big point. The other is we have the trinity: labor, value and price. And the question is what your aggregation is. The normal aggregation is labor and value and price. And that's not correct, because you have labor as a substance, quality and quantity for production as value, and on the other hand, value and prices. And of course, the values in chapter one, or volume one of Capital, are value prices, always denominated in money terms. So when you see this, think 80% or even 90% of the transformation problem could be abused if you read the production process in proper way, what is called constant and variable capital. And there you have the quality of producing new values by a living labor and preserving the value of the means of production by using it by useful labor. And Marx described quantitative proportions by alterations of values of the means of production and other variables to show how the production process goes. And I think this is just the same if we have production prices. There's nothing, no difference between the description in chapter 6 in the German edition or if you have production prices. So I agree with you, and if we do this, we don't need any mathematical framework based on the scheme of reproduction in the second, in the third chapter of volume two, transform values in prices, where always values are, or the inputs are faced as wages. What is variable capital is a sum of money, and yep. It is transformed into another quality, living labor, which is producing new values. And at the end of the process, that we have the value of production and we subtract the transferred, the preserved value of the means of production, and then we have the value product, which is produced new in the production process. And then we put away what the capitalist has to pay in wages for the laborers, and we have the surplus value as a residual, as a residual. And this is why the two identities of sum of prices are sum of values and sum of profits are sum of surplus values are already based in this distribution of production process.
Let me just say quickly, okay?
Yeah.
I mean, I think we agree. I mean, I think, and that's. I mean, I think you're at a good way of putting it. The theory of surplus value, right? That I guess it's not quite so clear there, but the value of the means of production, right, is the actual money advanced to purchase the means of production. So that constant capital component, the transferred value, right? That's the actual constant capital, right? And that then becomes the first component of the price. You know, whether or not that's equal to value of price, what it is, right? And then that's transferred. And the same thing with variable capital, right? Variable capital, what it is, right, is subtracted from the new value produced to determine the surplus value. And so there are no hypothetical quantities here. So thank you. And thank you for the quote in the preface too.
Okay, I must say I appreciated your talk very much. I think it's in full line in what you are saying. I think also this problem is a pseudo.
Is what?
An apparent, how to call it, pseudo.
Pseudo.
An apparent problem, it's not a real problem.
Pseudo.
Okay.
Right.
I also think you are right when you say there is no need for transforming money, value, so to say, to prices. Instead, I think it's the right idea that already the value has a price. So it's only so that the value probably has a price, but in this price, a production component, there is a modification of the value. Yeah, maybe it's not explained in the beginning, or it's set to zero, you can say. Yeah, so it's, I think, appreciated very much. It's already in, but it's not talked about because you have to start somewhere.
Right.
Maybe I say a little bit about where I'm coming from. I'm a computer scientist, so my profession is system analysis and system development for complex systems with many abstraction levels. And all these problems, so to say, that we're discussing here, we have also in these systems. We have always to start with a more simplified, formal approach. And then based on that, you can have the next abstraction level. If you don't start with a simple abstraction, you have no means in the hand to come to the complex stuff. It would be too confusing. So you cannot always talk about everything as a thing. You make some abstractions, you say something, and then you have to, later on when you refine your model, you have to add something. And so this is what I was doing, yeah? Because I give now since 4.5 years, I give capital lessons. I lead a capital leading circle since 4.5 years. Was started by Michael in the beginning, and in this way I wanted to try to model the whole issue, and I came to the same thing. I had in a certain moment in time I had to make a choice in my model. I really have made a computer model, so to say, a logical model. To model all this stuff, and they had to make a choice at one time. What is winning? Is the, so to say, the non-value part winning? Say that at the moment when we go from the M to C, yeah, when from the capital, so to say, we buy, so to say, the materials. And at that moment in time, the model had to make a choice. Had to make a choice. Who is winning? Is the capital winning, or is, so to say, the material stuff winning? If I would have put myself in this model on the side, then the material stuff is winning, I would be on the rougher side.
Yep.
But then I said, okay, what is capital really? Yeah, capital is the main, yeah, it's the prominent part. That's the reason why I appreciated you mentioning that you're by focusing on the circuit of capital.
Yep.
This was just the right thing. I said, okay, the circuit of capital, this is what capital is.
That's it.
Yeah? This is the heart of the whole story. So I have to put my model on this side. And then I was on a side where I always have money. And this is always, as you said, it's always the same. It's not changing. It's always the circuit is always changing. And the material has to follow. Yeah? And from that, so to say, I put my side on this and there was able to prove that all your equations you mentioned, they were fitting. Yeah? But then I had to make another small thing and this required me. So I was, the first 2 years of this 4.5 years, I was playing around with this Borkiewicz stuff. Yeah? I also have now a criticism of him, so it's more in my mind and only the opposite stuff, so it's more about this, that I also have criticism of the other guys. So what went wrong the last 100 years, so to say? And then I had still a problem, and this problem I could solve half a year back. And this problem was that I was required to change the specification of the value of Arbeitskraft, working of
labor power.
Because Marx has said the labor power is determined by the value, so to say, of the means of living they have to buy. And this said, in my model, it was only possible if I was required, so to say, to modify that, to say, no, Marx, so to say, this sentence as such is not true. I have to modify the sentence by saying labor, the value of labor power is not determined by value, it's determined by the product price of the means of living. And this I didn't dare to do because this was formally a contradiction to what Marx was saying. And this hint was hindering me 2 years, so to say, to come to the conclusion. Yeah? But at the end I was saying now it's logical. Because if he's on a lower abstraction level, he cannot talk about it.
Right.
Yeah?
Right.
So it means and if you want, and then I'm coming to my systems theory of computer science. Yeah? How we act there. Yeah, but I didn't dare in the beginning to use my computer science stuff in economic stuff. Yeah? But then I say it's logical. So we say once you're on the next abstraction level, then you have to check what you have to modify there. There's even in computer science, there's even a special operator for doing that. So this is used so often in system analysis, so to say, that every guy's in computer guys knows it. Yeah? You are able in computer science to overlay the operator. So you write a plus, and then maybe on the lowest abstraction level it's a plus. But then you come to something like, oh, the computer, I only have, it says, 8 bits or what? So the plus is ending somewhere. So you have to modify the plus. Yeah? Because after 8 bits, you go back to zero. So, and then you have a mechanism that you can overlay operators. Yeah? You can say, what I wanted to say is there's even standard stuff to solve these problems. So then I was coming to this, saying, okay, I have to modify Marx. I'm not modifying Marx, but I have to modify his words. And when I did that, so to say, the solution was there. And this fits perfectly to your philosophy that a production price is already existing on the lowest abstraction level already. Yeah? Only we are not talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, in that sense, I think that's. It's a great thing for me. What are you presenting?
Well, I'd say that's a great thing for me too. I mean, I really appreciate that. And please send me your model.
Okay.
My email's on the sheet, right?
Okay. First, you have to translate it in English, huh?
Right. Okay. But yes, I mean, I really do think we are thinking along similar lines in the way I would put it. You know, and I was also hung up for a long time by the same sentence, right, that the value of labor power is determined by the value of the means of subsistence, right? And so, but I think the way I understand that now, I can't do it in terms of computer language, but that in volume one, Marx is providing a partial explanation.
Exactly.
of variable capital, right? The variable capital is taken as given as the actual, right? And he can't explain the actual because the actual is price of production, and first you have to go through volume one, right? But so what he does in volume one is to provide a temporary, a partial explanation as equal to as determined mainly but not entirely by the value of the means of subsistence. Right, that this is the main determinant of variable capital. That's still true, right? It's not like that's wrong, right? It's just that it's partial, right? It's an approximation, right? At the abstract level, right? And then after prices of production has been explained, right? Then he can provide a more complete explanation of that same given variable capital, right? That same amount.
So, wir haben jetzt noch mehrere Meldungen. Also, we have several persons who want to speak.
Good.
And it's very interesting to talk, but I must beg you to be a little bit more short and concentrated to the point.
Are you aware of the so-called temporal single system adaptation of the transformation problem?
Yes, sure.
Because it seems to me that what they are arguing it in a different way, but it seems to me that it's basically the same solution, how they say it, how to handle the formulas and how to do the transformation. And can you say something about it?
Yes, I have a chapter on the temporal single system in my book. First part of my book is my interpretation, and the second part is a chapter for each of, you know, four or five of the major, the new interpretation and the TSSI. I'm sympathetic in some respects to the TSSI, but I'm kind of the least sympathetic with their interpretation of the transformation problem. Because what they argue is that the transformation is a multi-period process, right? In Kleinman and McClone's original article, it was 14 periods, right, which are assumed to be real historical periods, right? So they start with values. They start with values and values as labor times, right? And then they determine kind of prices of production at the end of the first period on the basis of values. Right, it's a kind of iterative solution, right? I mean, are you familiar with Shake's interpretation a little earlier? Anwar Shake has an iterative solution, but for Shake, it's purely a logical iteration, right? That happens all in one period. For the TSSI, it's a historical iteration that happens over many periods. So they start with values, and they say V and C are actually equal to values, and then they transform, and then that goes into the next period, a new set of inputs that are no longer values, but are but not yet kind of full long run equilibrium prices of production, right? So I think that they should, you know, start with V and C as actual to equal to the actual prices.
I thought they were doing that, but maybe I haven't understood.
No, I think. Thanks.
I want to make a connection with Marx's law of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. Also, there's a famous interpretation of that law of Marx, the so-called Fischinger theorem, and it is based on Sraffian theory.
Right.
So if you have now refuted Safa with your ideas, then that would mean that you have also refuted automatically his reputation of the law. So your ideas are somewhat are opening a new debate on that law, I would say. And so we can start to talk about the non-dependent.
I think absolutely yes. You know, that theory, the Okishio theorem, is based on Sraffian theory, right? And the conclusion follows, and clearly it follows, right, on the basis of Serafian theory. But what, you know, what I argue is that's a completely different theory from Marx's theory, and it's especially relevant to the Okishio theorem and the falling rate of profit, because, you know, if you look at the Serafian equations, right, which I have down at the bottom of the algebra sheet, right, the only place where L appears, right, labor, is as a cost, right? It's not a producer of value, right? So if it follows from this equation, from the Serafian equation, right, that if you can economize on labor, right, you're economizing on cost, right, and you will have a higher rate of profit, right? But what that leaves out from the Marxian point of view is that less labor also means less new value produced and less surplus value produced. So I certainly have been thinking about that too. And I think that is an implication that, Marxist theory is fundamentally different from Serafian theory. And I think that opens up a number of new avenues.
But to this point, I would like to add, Okishio takes an argument from the first volume of Capital about the restriction of the growth of the value of constant capital. He puts it in a Serafian framework. When we criticize fundamentally a Serafian framework, we cannot use, or we can easily criticize the framework also of Okishio, but still there is the argument of volume one, which he used, and maybe it can be used in a different framework, not in a Serafian framework. And so not everything is solved.
I'm not saying it's solved. I'm saying it's a new avenue for investigation.
It's correct. Right. Christian.
This M can be determined, because if I get it correctly, M assumes that there is a proportional relation between expended labor time and value. But on what level is this? How is M determined?
Good question. And for Marx, right, in Capital, M is determined by the value of money, right? And Marx assumed throughout Capital that money was commodity money, right? Real commodity money, and gold. And so the M, the value produced per hour, right, is the inverse of the labor time required to produce a unit of gold. Right, so the labor time required to produce a unit of gold, Marx assumes in a number of his examples, is 2 hours. Right, so 2 hours to produce an ounce or a shilling worth of gold. Right, so that means in 1 hour, a half shilling is produced, and that since gold is equated with all other industries, right, with the commodities produced in all other industries, Marx assumed, like in chapter 5, like in the textile industry of the half shilling, that the amount of gold produced per hour determines the new value produced per hour in all other industries. Okay, so...
relates to
Well, the M is the actual labor time required to produce a unit of gold, and that doesn't change. I would argue in moving from the macro to the micro, right? That's an important question, that's one question, you know, and that was also part of Bortkowitz's critique, right? That if the composition of capital in the gold industry is different from the average composition of capital, that would change the total value, right? I disagree with that interpretation. I've written a paper about that, which I would be happy to send you, and we can discuss further. But I think the other question that raises is that, you know, many would argue, and I think I would agree, that gold no longer functions as the measure of value. Right, that money is no longer based on gold, right, and the value of money, right. So that raises the further question, which I think is an even more difficult question, of how is the M determined in the current monetary system, which is not based on a real commodity, but is instead based on credit money and inconvertible credit money. I've also written a paper about that. I don't think completely solves the problem. I think that's somewhat of an important open question, right? I don't think that, but I think that's a separate question from the transformation.
Alex.
I was wondering if you could elaborate on the distinction that you made between capital in general and the competition of many capitals, and what the relevance of that is for the sort of macro and micro distinction you're making here. Because I find it intuitively sympathetic to say that already at the level of volume one, we're dealing with monetary magnitudes rather than sort of pre-monetary magnitudes that are then modified in volume three. But my traditional understanding was always that volume one was dealing with an individual capital, and then over the course of volume two, you then have an elaboration by Marx of how individual capitals interact, so that you have disproportionalities between various branches of production. And so I was wondering if you could maybe elaborate why is that a relevant distinction for the argument that you give here.
Yeah, I interpret the in volume one the analysis of the individual capital, right, or even the individual worker, right. That theory of surplus value in chapter five is in terms of one worker, right. I argue that worker and the individual capital in volume one represents the individual worker represents the working class as a whole. Right. This is not about one worker and the surplus value produced, and the reason why it can represent the working class as a whole is that the same theory applies, right, to each and every worker, right? So this is the representative worker that represents the working class as a whole, and therefore the surplus value produced is determined the total surplus value. Where volume two is most relevant to this discussion, I think, is the particularly part two of volume two and the turnover of capital, right? Because what volume one does is to determine the surplus value produced in a single circuit, let's say. Right, but then in a year, right, the capitals have more than one turnover, right, and so in order to determine, but what you need in volume three for the general rate of profit is not just the total surplus value, but the total annual surplus value, right? The general rate of profit is the annual rate of profit. That's what gets equalized, right, by competition, right? So what you need for volume three is the total annual surplus value, and in order to derive that, you need the volume two analysis of the turnover times and the success and the number of turnover, the number of circuits from each capital per year, right? So I would argue that volumes one and volume two then together determine the total annual surplus value, and that is at the level of abstraction of capital in general.
Now we have two persons who want to intervene, I think, to questions we had before. We are at the end of the formal time, so I ask you to be short, to come to the point. It is Stefan and Christian. Okay.
Later.
Yeah, actually, I wanted to ask a completely different question.
Ah.
Because I wondered whether you know the book The Laws of Chaos by,
yes.
Emmanuel Fayoun and Moshe Marcover.
Yeah.
And they argue that the whole transformation problem results from the equilibrium approach, that you think that there is an equal rate of profit. And then they say, well, there's a neoclassical faith, but it's not real. And I wondered what you think about that.
Well, we have to put Marx in his context of mid-19th century and trying to solve Ricardo's problem, right? And that this had been, and it's still today, but certainly for Ricardo, this had been the main criticism of Ricardo's theory by Malthus and Torrens and others, that the labor theory of value seems to contradict or contradicted by equal rates of profit across industries. So the whole debate, right, has assumed this equalization of profit rates across industry. And so, I think Marx felt compelled, and for good reason, to solve this problem, right? And to explain, even though he said, there are lots of obstacles to the equalization and in the real world, it may never actually happen, right? But assuming there is at least a tendency toward equalization, this is how it can be explained. I don't think he was really, I think he was trying to answer the critics rather than necessarily argue that there is a real world equalization. And if there's not a real world equalization, this doesn't really affect Marx's theory, right? Because it just means that some industries get more than the average and other industries get less than the average, right? And again, I certainly don't pretend to put myself in Marx's place, but I'm trying to answer the critics too, right? And the criticisms of Marx, aside from Laws of Chaos, right, the kind of standard debate over the transformation problem has assumed this equalization, and so I'm there are other reasons why I'm not too sympathetic to the laws of chaos, I'm trying to answer the criticism that the labor theory of value is contradicted by this tendency, and if there's not a tendency, that really doesn't damage or contradict Marx's theory, I don't think.
So, thank you very much, Fred, for this really inspiring presentation, and you all for the discussion and the inspiring questions. I think
yes, indeed.
We all can take something with us from this nice evening. And the only I can say, thank you and have a good night, good evening.
Okay, ich dachte, es wäre jetzt mit dem Text hier an der Stelle.
Ja, ja, alles klar.
Ich dachte jetzt nur, dass da
ist.
Ich dachte nur, das sei jetzt eine Stelle mit dem Text.